for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Former Iranian President Rafsanjani led Friday prayers in Iran today, a move that may fuel more political unrest in that country's disputed election. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton responded to reports she's been sidelined in foreign policy matters by saying, quote, "I broke my elbow, not my larynx." And ousted Honduran President Zelaya is reportedly planning a return to his homeland to confront leaders of the recent coup there. Joining me for this week's International Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine, Yogi Driessen with The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post, David Ignatius. Of course, we look forward to hearing your contributions, your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
The latest on these bomb attacks in Jakarta, Moises. We've heard reports, conflicting reports, 8 people, 9 people killed. We're not sure. Do we know who might be responsible?
The main suspect is a group called Jamaat Islamiya, who is Al-Qaeda connected and has been seen as responsible for all the bombings. That same hotel, the Marriott, there were two hotels that were bombed, a Ritz-Carlton and a Marriott. That same hotel had been bombed before. They also bombed the very well-known bombing in the Bali area that also had a lot of tourists killed. This is a group that works throughout East Asia. Its leader had been jailed and is now in jail again. Others of his leaders have been jailed, escaped, and have been captured again. The Singapore's intelligence services have been after them, but also the Indonesian. And so this is a resurfacing of this group. Some people have mentioned that some of them have been released recently, and that may explain a resurgence of this group.
And, you know, this comes at a time when the people of Indonesia had begun to breathe more easily, Yoki.
It did. And it's also a reminder that in this globalized world we live in, one bombing can hit multiple countries regardless of where it takes place. I mean, in this case, you had a bombing in Indonesia, one of the world's biggest, you know, by most measures, the biggest Muslim country on the planet, killing a fair number of Indonesians. It hit hotels that are American-owned, so you have an American connection. This same group was responsible for the bombing in Bali that killed several hundred Australians, which was the worst terror attack in the history of Australia. So when you have this type of bombing, there's unrest it causes in Indonesia for Indonesians. But then the ripple effects also hit the United States. They also hit Australia. They also hit Singapore. And they just sort of ripple on and on and on.
David, what is the current political situation in Indonesia that would bring this kind of terrorism to the fore?
The government has been relatively successful economically. It's a country that has been seen as moving quickly toward greater prosperity. It is, you know, a somewhat repressive regime. But I think what this tells us is that even in countries that are advancing rapidly, there are these extremist Muslim movements with deep roots. People had been pretty hopeful that Jamaat Islamiyah, as a result of very aggressive intelligence work by services out there, had really been suppressed. And this seems to be telling us, no, that is not so. I would just note that people I know who follow these matters closely are very concerned about what's happening in the Philippines. Like Indonesia, it's a place with many scattered islands. It's a big, diffuse country. And it is said that Al-Qaeda-related cells are now putting down deep roots in some of these remote areas of the Philippines. So it's a part of the world that we've gotten used to not thinking about much, and here's a wake-up call today.
And the U.S. response, Yoki?
I think the response will be, in some ways, continuing what it's been doing up till now, which is the indirect use and, in some cases, direct assistance by American intelligence and special operations advisors to the Indonesians. Just to build on David's point for a moment, In the Philippines, the kind of equivalent to Jamaya Islamiya was the Abu Sayyaf group, which was a very violent al-Qaeda-derived terror group that U.S. Special Operations and the CIA has been helping the Philippines for years, and there was a sense of optimism that perhaps Abu Sayyaf had been, to a degree, neutralized. At the same time, David's point is exactly right. There's some fear that offshoots of Abu Sayyaf are coming back in the Philippines at the same time that Jamaya Islamiya, that again, there was some optimism that maybe after Bali in particular, that it also had been, to a degree, neutralized, to a degree. There, too, you're seeing it come back as well.
It's worth remembering that these need not be highly centralized, coordinated groups. They may be groups that are just spontaneously emerge and are connected to others. But there is not a central command for all these entities.
I would just note, following up Moises's point, that some of the U.S. Counterterrorism analysts at the National Counterterrorism Center worry that as we hit Al-Qaeda Central harder and harder and really break its ability to coordinate operations, this is what we're going to see. We're going to see a fragmentation with many different cells operating independently. And people note, they may not have the capacity to do mega attacks like 9/11, but there's some very, very dangerous things they could do, and they could even increase as you hit the center harder.
David Ignatius, he's a columnist for the Washington Post, co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. Yoki Driessen reports on military affairs for the Wall Street Journal. And Moises Naim is editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. You can join the discussion, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Yoki Driessen, I know you're headed out of the country, and one of your stops will be Iran. Former President Rafsanjani led weekly prayers for the first time since the disputed election, and thousands of people came out for it.
They did, and it's interesting that in the week since Khamenei has tried to sort of declare this election finished, completed,
over,
that, you know, go back home, get off the streets, you've seen that it is nowhere near completed or finished, in large part because the clerical establishment is not willing to go along with it. So you have Rafsanjani, a figure who is obviously, you know, straddled both the political sphere of Iran, but also the, you know, the clerical sphere, but other clerics as well, giving speeches that, although veiled and full of analogies and metaphor, are seen almost universally as condemning Khamenei, condemning Ahmadinejad, and saying that this election is not settled.
So what is Rafsanjani saying to the people of Iran?
You know, some of this is hard to read because most of it is said indirectly, but it's being interpreted, at least in the Iranian press that I've seen and in the Iranian Twitter feeds and blogs that I've seen, as sort of cautious support for some of the protesters in the street and sort of a cautious saying to them that not everyone supports Khamenei, not everyone supports Ahmadinejad, and this is not finished.
He also urged the authorities to free those who had been arrested during the protest, Moises.
Yes, Rafsanjani did not come out strongly against the government, but he was quite explicit. He's reported by the Associated Press as having said, doubt has been created about the election results. There is a large portion of the wise people who say they have doubts. We need to take action to remove these doubts.
What kind of action is he talking about?
Well, that's where Yoichi is right, that he has to be very careful. He has to be metaphorical. He cannot go straight to it. One part of the report that called my attention, I thought was very interesting, is that this was a very large event held at a stadium with tens of thousands of people in attendance. And there were chants. You know, Mousavi, the candidate that claims to have won the election and the government not recognizing it, was seated in the first row. And there was this became a highly politicized event. In the midst of that event, different parties started chanting. When some started chanting the traditional death to America, others started chanting death to Russia, death to China, which means that in response to the fact that they perceive that China and Russia are too supportive of the regime of Ahmadinejad and are just complicit on the repression that has been taking place since the election.
David.
I've been in that vast open-air mosque and watched people chanting at Friday prayers. I'll tell you, it's quite a sight.
I'll bet.
I would just caution about Rafsanjani. Rafsanjani really is playing a double game here. He was speaking to the crowd today about the election, and he was criticizing the government's handling of the crisis, saying that it had been divisive, it had created two currents in Iran. But as I read the initial translations of his sermon, I was struck by his calls for unity and a unity in which he would play a more central role. I mean, I think his game since the election has been in part trying to enhance his role. It's very interesting. If you read the Iranian press in translation, which you can do, the Supreme Leader Khamenei several weeks ago said that he didn't think that former President Rafsanjani was corrupt, as Ahmadinejad had charged during the election campaign. Kind of let him off the hook. And then a week or so after that, Rafsanjani said that he didn't want to challenge the Supreme Leader's authority. He made nice to the Supreme Leader. So, I mean, my guess is that Rafsanjani is trying to enhance his own position and that of his group. He's bringing the followers of Mousavi along. But the idea that he is a fundamental dagger pointed at the heart of the clerical regime, I'm just not sure that's
right.
Quick
point, Moises.
Well, he has gone farther than that. He said, for example, in his sermon, he said, we believe in the Islamic Republic. They have to stand together. If Islamic doesn't exist, we go astray. And if Republic is not there, our goals would not be achieved. Where people are not present or the vote is not considered, the government is not Islamic.
Moises Naim, he's editor-in-chief, Foreign Policy Magazine. Short break. We'll be right back. And the phones are open. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet. You can reach us through Facebook. Let's talk about what's happening in Afghanistan. General McChrystal gave an assessment of what's going on there, David. 1 month into the job, he said he was surprised by the resilience of pockets of Pashtun militants. What's all that about?
General McChrystal, the new commander, who's coming out of command in Iraq, where he ran our special operations forces there, is really trying to formulate a new battle plan for Afghanistan. And I think he is reckoning with the reality that in southern Afghanistan in particular, the Taliban has really dug in deep. The last time I was in Kabul, I can remember seeing a map in the Interior Minister's office, and you look at that map, and he colors the areas that are out of government control, in Taliban control, red. And the bottom of the map is just a swath of red. And that's what McChrystal's trying to sort out now. The strategy is to send in troops. We sent Marines into the Helmand province area to try to break up these Taliban formations. That part is called clearing. It's a clearing operation. But the problem in Afghanistan, and I think this is what McChrystal's focused on, is holding the areas once you've cleared them, having sufficient forces to maintain stability. The insurgents scatter initially, but then they come back. And I think where McChrystal is heading is to have more U.S. forces, yes. I mean, we have 21,000 additional U.S. troops coming. But really, I think the focus is going to be on additional Afghan forces. I'm hearing talk that the numbers may increase from a current plan of roughly 250,000 army and Afghan police. This is Afghan. Now, this is not U.S.
Yeah.
To something like 400,000. That's a big force.
Where is he going to get them? Are they going to be willing to belong to this kind of force, Yoki?
Well, I think there are two issues. One is a willingness to join, which I think will be there in part because unemployment in Afghanistan is staggeringly high. And as in Iraq, if you offer a big paycheck, you will get people coming at least initially. The problem will be oversight and the problem will be training. I spent some time last time I was in Afghanistan at the main training center, and most Afghan recruits are illiterate. So U.S. personnel who have experience training the Iraqi army have to suddenly take all the kind of handouts that they had planned to just translate into Pashto or Dari and hand out again to the Afghans and redo it because they can't use written handouts. So everything now is by demonstration. So you have one problem of training and one problem of oversight. It's not at all clear that in the Afghan National Army, if you expand it that quickly, that fast, that big, will be able to maintain loyalty to Kabul as opposed to loyalty to its tribe, loyalty to its region, which then raises the question about the return of warlordism.
Moises.
The military challenges are overwhelming, but they pale in comparison to the civilian challenges. The whole notion of trying to gain the hearts and minds of the population, the notion that this will never be won unless the civilians begin to start supporting their government and against the Taliban. This week was very revealing of the contradictions and the tensions. And as General McChrystal was expressing his surprise about the resistance and the need for deepening the military operations, a patrol was attacked, and they called in helicopters. The helicopters came, and in the process, several civilians were killed, and 13 were wounded, including women and children. So that shows you the difficulty of maintaining security at the same time of trying to gain the support of a population.
How long does General McChrystal think the U.S. is going to be in Afghanistan, David?
Well, when General Petraeus, his boss, the CENTCOM commander, briefs people about Afghanistan, he has a slide that says, Afghanistan, the longest campaign. So he's talking about years. I mean, talk to people privately that they say, you know, 5 to 10 years is a reasonable time frame, and they know that the basic question is, does the U.S. have the staying power? And as a political issue, Afghanistan is already being called Obama's Vietnam, and within the administration there are strong voices criticizing deeper U.S. involvement. One of the key people who was skeptics is Vice President Biden, who really isn't sure that this is a winnable war and that we should keep adding troops. This fall, after the operations that McChrystal is leading now, there's going to be a review of policy. And I think you can look forward to a very interesting debate within the administration, and it'll be echoed on Capitol Hill and in the press, about where we're going. Is this working? Are we getting the return for the forces we're putting in? How long is it going to last? How many people are going to die? Those are the questions people will be talking about.
One question will be, is it working? The other question will be, is it worth it? I mean, if at the end of the day, 20 years in from now, Afghanistan looks like Chad, let's say, that is still staggeringly poor but less so, that is still staggeringly corrupt, less so, still a narco state, less so, is that worth tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars plus thousands of American lives? The only other point that I would add to it is that this sort of debate that's happening here happens at the same time as this remarkable reversal on the ground. The Afghan election is less than a month away. Hamid Karzai, who is massively unpopular both within the U.S. officials in Afghanistan, who are angry that he's constantly bashing American troops, but also among the Afghans, seems destined to cruise to pretty easy re-election. And you've had the switch where, if you remember a couple of years ago, leaked documents came out about Maliki, how the Bush administration was eavesdropping the Iraqi prime minister's phones amidst all this fear about how weak Maliki was and how sectarian he was and how poor of a leader he was. Karzai at the time was seen as the model. 2 years later, Maliki is stronger than ever in Iraq. Karzai is weaker and more corrupt and more despised than ever in Afghanistan.
And meanwhile, you had U.S. Army General David McKiernan at his own retirement ceremony at Fort Myer, Virginia, standing next to Secretary of Defense Gates and saying what, David?
He said that he had thought a month ago he might not be at his own retirement ceremony, that he was hurt. He said, "I was more than a little embarrassed by the way in which I was relieved." He was summarily fired from that job by Secretary Gates, who flew out to Afghanistan to tell him, and replaced well before the normal end of his tour by General McChrystal, the new commander, and General Rodriguez, who came in an additional new role. This is something that has really upset the sort of career people in the Army, that they feel that General McKiernan was a classic old Army guy. You know, he wasn't flashy. He didn't really like talking to the press. I've interviewed him a couple times in Afghanistan, and it's true, he doesn't like talking to the press. But he was seen as a good, one of our guys, if you're a
why was he replaced?
Because the judgment was made, we are in a war. This war absolutely depends on creative tactics, creative counterinsurgency tactics. And in the end, Secretary Gates and the president decided McKiernan was not the person to lead this. So there were bruised feelings, which McKiernan expressed, but I think people throughout the administration would say, look, we're at war. We can't worry about a general's feelings. This could have been handled in a better way, but it was the right change to make.
Now, part of it is the manner in which he was fired. I mean, Secretary Gates did it, went to Kabul, fired him, then at a press conference announcing it a week or so later was asked, will this end his career, and very bluntly said, probably. And so it's not just old Army that was struck by it. It's not just Army that was struck by it, but military officers of almost every service were sort of mortified at what they saw as the humiliation of a four-star general.
But the general was also very graceful in his retirement. He said that, of course, make no mistake, I was dismayed, disappointed, and more than a little embarrassed. But so often in life, I received some candid coaching that said, McKiernan, this is not about you. It's about paying respect to your profession and those around who know you. And so this is another chapter in this history that essentially points to a larger issue that David alluded to, and that is the notion that for this campaign, you need more special operations, you need more creative, different than the traditional approaches in the Army.
Or maybe you need to rethink the whole operation, which you're also alluding to, David.
They have the two of the smartest, most creative generals in the Army now in charge of this, in McChrystal and Rodriguez. They have General Petraeus giving overall supervision. They have Carl Eikenberry, a former top general, as the ambassador. They have a first-rate staff in the embassy. I mean, you know, they're going to give it the best shot. But as Yoki said, as we've all been saying, this is really hard.
Yep.
And I think there's going to be there should be a searching political debate about whether it's going to work.
And there hasn't been. I mean, I was at an event a couple of weeks ago where you had a panel that included several young military specialists from a think tank called the Center for New American Security, as well as a very, very smart, kind of iconoclastic Boston University professor named Andrew Basevich, who's become exceedingly critical of the Afghan war and sees it as misguided at its core. And he was making the point that every argument being made now about the importance of Afghanistan, you can make about Mexico. And Mexico is both a bigger trading partner, closer to our border, and every way more important. He was arguing, if we're going to spend all this money, all these lives, focused on Mexico, and he was laughed at by the crowd. But what that gets at is that there's no debate. Right now, we are funneling tens of thousands of troops, hundreds of billions of dollars to Afghanistan. The debate, if there is one, is about this general or that general. It's about the tactics of a war that all of Washington accepts. There isn't a debate, and there probably should be, about is this war worth it?
Well, the debate in the United States is just beginning. In the UK, is raging. In England, they have suffered losses, and every one of those generates a very spirited debate. There is as much skepticism and doubt about the wisdom of this campaign, about the presence of NATO and others there. And so and the fact that this is happening in one of the United States' staunchest allies will also have consequences here.
All right, and let's turn now to Iraq and the latest on violence there, David. You had three American soldiers killed Thursday after insurgents fired mortar rounds into a U.S. base In southern Iraq, you've also got problems with the Kurds. You've got lots of issues still going on, even as the U.S. is planning its pullout.
This was a week, Diane, that reminded us of the underlying fragility of Iraq. We've gotten in the habit of not paying much attention to it. Our troops are pulling back from the cities under the timetable we agreed with the Iraqis. And this last week we saw in these bombings and in the political conflicts just how easily Iraq could spin back into a very chaotic situation. Take the bombings that happened on Wednesday. By my count, there were about 11 people killed, something like 50 or 60 wounded. But what was striking was that one of the bombs was in Ramadi, in the Sunni heartland, the area we thought had been stabilized by our counterinsurgency work. Another bomb was in Sadr City. Another was right in the heart of Baghdad in Sadun Street. Those latter two were really going after Shiites. The first in Ramadi was going after Sunnis. More of these bombings are going to, again, make Iraqis frightened that they can't be secure without the protection of militias. Mm. And then you were back in the sectarian killing game, and you're going to start finding 50 bodies, dead bodies, every morning in the morgue.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And what's going on with the Kurds, Yoki?
In many ways, this is the most dangerous aspect of Iraq right now. You've had recently a standoff between Kurdish fighters and Iraqi National Army fighters. Last year, there was an incident that did not get much attention here in which U.S. drones that were monitoring a similar standoff saw columns of armed Iraqi army soldiers and columns of Kurdish Peshmerga racing towards each other. By the count of everyone who was watching it, bruising for a fight, and they stood down only amidst much mediation by both U.S. Mm-hmm. embassy and military, as was the case here where there was U.S. mediation. And what you have is this very thorny issue about what will be the boundaries between Kurdistan, what will be the boundaries between Arab Iraq, how will they divide oil, how will they divide Kirkuk. These issues have been kicked down the road again and again and again, and now they're at the end of the road. They have to at some point be resolved. I think what you've seen is when the U.S. invaded, there was a status quo that existed under Saddam that was toppled. There was a Sunni-led status quo. Then there was a new status quo that was not sustainable, where you had fighting between Sunni and Shia Arabs, and the Kurds were kind of left off to their own devices in the north. Now you have a new status quo where the Shia-Sunni tensions are much, much reduced, the Arab tensions, and now they're focusing much more again on the Arab-Kurdish tensions that were there under Saddam decades ago.
And the Kurdish prime minister yesterday said that the Kurdish autonomous region was closer to going to war with the central government than ever before since 2003, since the U.S. invasion. And that points, as Yoiki said, to the tensions about the divisions, federalism. They're trying to find out what is the divisions and of authority power between a centralized government and the regional government. This is a region that is quite different in its governance, in its functioning, in its economy and its politics than the rest of the country.
And the United States population is certainly concerned, as is the Iraqi, that what if the violence continues to uptick, gets worse? Do troops reinvigorate U.S. troops? What do you do?
Well, for the administration, I think there's a recognition that as we reduce our military presence there, it is inevitable that violence will increase, and that's accepted. And it's just a price of our getting out. The Iraqis want us out. We want to get out. So some increase in violence, it's understood, will happen. And the question is, will the Iraqi forces be strong enough to contain it within acceptable levels? And what's your choke point? If you're President Obama and you're seeing 10 people die a day, well, you know, what do you say that way? Suppose it gets up to 50. What do you do then? And that's, I mean, it's grisly, but that's the kind of decision I fear that the Obama administration is going to have to make about Iraq over the coming year.
It's very hard to imagine that there's a political environment in the United States that will support a massive increase of troops, of U.S. troops in Iraq. The line there will be crossed if Iran becomes a very influential country in Iraq, if Iranian influence there, which is, doesn't seem to be the case, but that it will be then the political basis for
and
an expansion.
Just one last word on that. Despite what's happening in Iran with the questions about the election, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says we must be engaged.
Yeah, she was echoing words of President Obama a short time earlier, who made very much the same point. And it becomes the political dynamics here surrounding engagement to Iran have, of course, changed dramatically, where post-Bush administration there was a lot of support in Washington for the idea of at least seeing what could be had as far as a dialogue with Iran. The imagery of Iran beating protesters, torturing protesters, hauling them off to prison where they're not heard from again for weeks, the level of political opposition, even among Democrats, to engagement with Iran is much, much higher than it was even 2-3 months ago.
Yoki Driessen, he's military correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. When we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Honduras and take your calls as well. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University and by this and other NPR stations, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
With his new movie, Bruno, Sacha Baron Cohen has once again succeeded in making a lot of people laugh and think, while also making a lot of people really uncomfortable. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with Sacha Baron Cohen. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We'll go right to the phones and have you join in the conversation during this week's Friday News Roundup, first to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'll try to make this real simple. If the United States somehow luckily was not in Afghanistan or Iraq, and we weren't right on the front line of everything, would these horrible attacks still be going on in India, and as the one was this morning, or in the Philippines? Are these always directed at us, or would they still be proceeding if the United States wasn't seen as a frontline player or a country with troops stationed over there?
Okay, Leslie, thanks for your call. Yoki.
I mean, it's in many ways sort of the key question about foreign policy. It's sort of like in quantum physics, where you talk about the act of observing something changes it. Does the simple act of our presence, even minimally, cause violence? I would think that the answer is very likely no. I mean, it may be less violence, but we tend to think that anything happens anywhere in the world is in some way directed to us, and that's simply arrogance and hubris, because it often is not. you know, many countries have homegrown insurgencies, they have homegrown political disputes that would take place and have taken place even when we're not paying attention to them, and even if we're not there. There are attacks where I think they are driven in part by hatred of us. There are attacks that are driven by their own homegrown domestic issues, and I think that it's too simplistic to say that if we were not there, violence would cease the world over.
I think there are a lot of people who are asking, however, had we not gone into Iraq in 2003, would this series of events have occurred, David?
Well, Al-Qaeda, from its beginnings in the 90s, was focused not on the U.S. initially, but on overthrowing the regime in Saudi Arabia. Other offshoots of Al-Qaeda want to overthrow regimes in Indonesia, other places, and install what they see as true Muslim regimes. And they go after the United States because we're seen as propping up those regimes. So the idea that if we disappeared, they'd stop attacking, I think, goes against their doctrine. That said, I think it's increasingly accepted by people who study counterinsurgencies that we have to be very careful about getting into places like Iraq, because we do create antibodies to our presence. When we come in with hundreds of thousands of troops, people who might not have had a quarrel against us in the beginning decide they're pretty angry at us. David Kilcullen, an Australian military officer I respect a lot, has written a book called The Accidental Guerrilla, in which that's his thesis. These people didn't start off planning to be anti-U.S. insurgents. It almost happened by accident because they got caught up in a cycle after we invaded. And I think it's something people really should think about as they look at the future. I mean, we're in Afghanistan. We're in Iraq. We do have to think about how to get out without making things a whole lot worse. But in terms of new adventures like this, that be careful.
All right. To Paul in Urbana, Illinois. Good morning. You're on the air. Paul, are you there? Okay. As I understand it, Paul wanted to ask about Honduras. What's happening there? What is the current situation? And would Manuel Zelaya, who says he wants to go back and confront those who have conducted a coup, how would he be received, Moises?
With jail, they will try to jail him, but he will, knowing that, he'll come well prepared. He is preparing. There are some informations that say that they have strong military support, disguised as militias and civilians, but are in fact Venezuelans and Cubans and Nicaraguan agents that are well armed, well trained, and ready to help him get back into his country and establish an alternative government. Meanwhile, there are negotiations going on in Costa Rica, headed by Oscar Arias, who is a Nobel Prize winner that is trying to mediate between these two parties.
And what about the U.S. position on this?
The U.S., since the beginning, condemned the coup and demanded that President Zelaya is reinstated in power, and that this is done peacefully, and that some of the grievances that led to his ouster were also acknowledged. It is very important that, to understand that we're dealing here with a very interesting but very tragic situation of the clash of two kinds of coups. We have a 20th century power grab by the military, a traditional coup d'etat by generals, but we were fighting another coup d'etat, which is a 21st century coup staged by jurists and constitutional lawyers, which is President Zelaya's attempt to change the constitution illegally, to stay in power and, in effect, use democracy and some tools of democracy to undermine democracy.
So you've got the military trying its own coup d'etat. You have the sitting president saying, I'll change the constitution.
The military reacted to the attempt of a constitutional coup by President Zelaya that imitates what has happened in elsewhere in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Ecuador.
And how do you sort this out? Is there enough support for him to come back to power?
there is a lot of support out from outside the country. President Zelaya has the support of the international community, of President Chavez.
Well, that's one thing, but...
But internally, his support is very limited. His calls for a national strike have not been received. There has not been a national strike. The street demonstrations on his support have been very meager. There is talk now of a solution, and that President Micheletti, who is the de facto president that replaced him, he has offered that he would resign, provided that President Zelaya doesn't come back. But there are calls, and one of the options that President Oscar Arias, the mediator, is trying to achieve is a unity government in which there will be a government composed of the two factions. But that's very unlikely, and there is a lot of writing in this small country because it sends very important signals about the dominance of Hugo Chavez and others in the region.
How much has Hugo Chavez been involved in this whole episode, David?
I honestly don't know. He's got lots of money to spend. I had the pleasure last week of interviewing a man who symbolizes what's the positive trends in the region, the president of Colombia, Uribe, but who is also tempted by this desire to be president for life. He is had a spectacular success in containing the insurgency, beating the FARC, stopping the narco traffickers to some extent in Colombia. But he's now tinkering, or supporters are talking about tinkering with the Constitution so he can extend his term to a third term. And it's sort of depressing. Here's a real hero, but the temptation in that part of the world to go for too much power is obvious, as Moises said.
How's it going to work out, David?
It's going to work out the way it always has, slowly. I mean, well, the question, I think, for Americans is, what's our role going to be? For so many years, anti-Americanism has been an organizing principle in Latin America. A real challenge for Obama is to find a way for us to be actively involved in a positive way. You know, Cuba, I think, finding a way to open relations with Cuba would be opening a door in general in Latin America. But that's a really interesting challenge.
One last point. Moises.
One of the interesting ways in which things have changed is that one of the accusations about that has been leveled at Hugo Chavez is that he has become the George W. Bush in this era, that he is the one that is interfering in other countries. He's the one that is operating with his forces elsewhere. So that tells you how flux and fluid the situation is.
All right. And to Charlotte, North Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Okay, hi. I'd like to make a comment about what Hillary Clinton said yesterday about Iran having a jump, because she's speaking. Okay, I have friends that used to live there in the 60s and 70s, and they used to tell me how our government used to help torture and kill those people. Okay, they're probably the same people that are related to the people who are leaders today. Okay, so, this is the same thing that we're doing right now in Palestine. On Friday, last Friday, I watched the march, and the Israeli army tear gassed a bunch of women and children. Okay, anybody could go to Gaza, the killing zone, and you could watch the Israeli army committing war crimes against children and women.
Thanks for your call, Frank Kyoki.
On the issue of Iran, the U.S. did support the Shah. The Shah's Savak Secret Service did torture prisoners. The U.S. also was involved in deposing President Mossadegh, which Obama, in his speech in Cairo, went out of his way to formally apologize for. There's no question that there's bad blood. Iran, for years, has had justifiable anger at the U.S. Arguably, the U.S., since the taking of the embassy in Tehran, has had justifiable anger against Iran, too. Obama, in all of his public remarks, has tried to go out of his way to try to figure out some way of getting past that, to acknowledge American failings, and to say to the Iranians, speaking of their country by its formal official name, giving them greetings on Nowruz, on one of a major holiday within Iran, trying to work past this long, long, long era of bad blood between the two countries.
All right, to Charlie in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to go back to the Middle East a little bit in terms of I think that Iraq is a lost cause. I think Sadr, the Ayatollah Sadr's militia, has only stood down under orders from Iran and under realization that the U.S. military would destroy Sadr City. They will resurge, and they will take over the South, if not, and have it's very informal, maybe union with Iran. The Sunnis were bought off with U.S. money and Viagra pills for their ancient sheikh, so that's the truth, not a joke. And the Kurds, our most loyal allies, are the largest tribe, as far as I know, on Earth without a homeland. And I'm afraid that they, especially with the oil money, do not intend to be left behind this time. I think also, I'd like one more comment on the Gaza situation again. We just had 25 active and called up reservists testify to war crimes from Israel, and we never got that even around my lay in our country. It's not an easy thing to do for active military.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. David.
Well, I think it's too early for me, at least, to say that Iraq is a lost cause. One interesting fact about Iraq is that our greatest potential problem, which is Iranian influence, Iranian support for extremist militias like Muqtada Sadr, who the caller was referring to, Iran politically is imploding. That threat, that the ability of Iran to destabilize Iraq is, I think, somewhat reduced. I want to say significantly reduced because of the chaos following the election. Mm-hmm. And I think you can generalize that to potential Iranian clients all over. I mean, there are political parties in Iraq that are supported by Iran must be worrying, holy smokes, our paymasters are in trouble. Same is true for Hezbollah in Lebanon. Same may be true for Hamas in among the Palestinians. And so this is really a golden opportunity to go to people who really cause us trouble, who are backed by Iran, and try to pull them away and say, here's another way to do it. Here's another future.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And speaking about the question of Gaza and the testimony of the 13 Israeli soldiers, what can you comment? Yoki.
This is part of a continuing debate within Israel, sort of very painful, very intimate debate, since in Israel everyone serves. So when the army has a role publicly, the whole country listens very closely because the whole country has a stake in it. And you've had, since the end of the hostilities, various reports surface, mainly from within the military, about soldiers saying they occasionally fired on unarmed Palestinian children, that they would use Palestinians as human shield, in part by resting their rifle on the shoulder of a Palestinian and walking behind them. You've had continuing questions about the use of white phosphorus, which, if it touches the skin, can burn very terribly, and as a result is largely banned in the use of urban combat. At the same time, you've had another stream of thought within Israel that says the war did not go nearly far enough, that it should not have stopped until Hamas was out of power, and that only with Hamas out of power can the peace talks that President Obama is pushing for so strongly could they have any chance of success. So within Israel, you've had one debate sort of with the United States, because Obama has been pushing Israel harder than George Bush ever did, but you've also had in some ways a more intimate and more painful debate within Israel about its conduct in the past and its outlook for the future.
Moises.
In the midst of all the very bad news coming from the region, as usual, there is a ray of good news this week. And that is a report saying that the situation in the West Bank is moderately improving, that the economy is picking up, that the Palestinian Authority is exerting more power, that its police forces are now better trained, that they are following more modern principles of policing, and that, again, as I said, that the economy is moving forward. So you have the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and you have Hamas in Gaza. And the compare and contrast, the exercise of comparing and contrasting the two areas can be very telling and can have powerful political consequences.
All right, and one last question from Oklahoma City. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Let's talk about Iraq for a second. A comment. We have basically destroyed the country, you know, in the last 20 years of Iraq. And now it's not good enough just to bring the soldiers out. We need to start talking about, you know, fixing the country, reparations. And my comment would be for Obama, I hope he has enough backbone to start talking about this. What can we do to help Iraq as far as besides just pulling our military out?
David.
Well, it's a good point. Iraq's a very rich country. It has oil reserves that some people think are second only to Saudi Arabia. So what we can do for Iraq is try to encourage stability in which Iraq can produce and sell a lot more oil, make a lot more money, and rehabilitate itself. I think One argument that people make for not racing out of Iraq is that having gone in and having busted the country up, which we did, and we will be debating for the rest of our lives whether that was wise and why we did it, the idea that we can just race out and leave this mess to the Iraqis to sort out. The Syrian foreign minister, Waleed Wallam, once said to me when we were talking about this, he said, but David, that would be immoral. There is something immoral about leaving behind this completely chaotic situation, and I think the caller's right. We got to the extent we can, help the Iraqis put that country back together and become prosperous again.
Last word.
Thus far, the U.S. has spent somewhere in the area of $30 billion on reconstruction. A lot of it was wasted. A lot of it went to corruption. But there are things that are better than before, particularly electricity. The notion that there'll be reparations of any kind to Iraq in any sense of it is just not happening.
Yogi Driessen of the Wall Street Journal, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, Moises Naim of Foreign Policy Magazine. I'll be on vacation for the next 2 weeks. My good colleagues will be here sitting in this chair. I'll be back with you on the 3rd of August. Have a great 2 weeks, everybody. Happy Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.